Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Aaron Seideman, whose new memoir is Postcards from the Sky, Notes of an Aviatrix. We'll also hear from Elizabeth Sanders, whose new novel is The Last Light. New Orleans native Aaron Seideman is a woman in love with flight, and that love is on every page of her memoir, Postcards from the Sky, Adventures of an Aviatrix. It's a great true adventure story, and it will warm the heart of every English major, let me tell you. Aaron Seideman, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you. You know, it's always nice to be on a show that you've listened to for years, so thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. Now, one of the first things we have to address is this one simple fact about you, that you get motion sickness.
I do. It is something that you can very slowly overcome with time, but I still get motion sick sometimes if the turbulence is really bad, or even if I'm riding in a car and it's a jerky driver. I still get it. It's something that really never goes away.
So that was a limitation you had to overcome right away with flying, right?
Definitely. And I did overcome it because after a while I did start flying aerobatics, which is a crazy thing for someone with motion sickness to do. But it was something that I wanted to do so badly. I just, you know, you just do it as much as you can up to the point that you get motion sick and then stop and then try to do a little bit more the next time. So, you know, like anything you want to do, you just keep going at it.
So tell us about your first experience with flight. What was it that drew you right into this world?
You know, I don't even actually remember my very first experience with flight, but because, you know, getting on a commercial airliner is so much different than getting on a small plane, I do remember my first small plane experience. And that was on a seaplane in Key West on a family vacation. And to me, it was just wonderful, the things that you could see from the plane. Because, you know, normally when you get on a commercial airliner, you might see something a few minutes right after you take off, a few minutes right before you land. But everything in between is just a vast landscape if you can see it, or maybe there's a cloud layer. So the smaller planes truly do open up a whole new world and a completely new perspective that so few people get to see. And it's amazingly, amazingly beautiful.
Yes. One of the things that's so interesting to me is that, you know, when you ride on a commercial plane, you don't feel the air the way you do in a small plane. You know, if it's just like a control freak's dream to be in a small plane. You know what I mean?
It truly is. And I find myself, since I got my pilot's license, I never used to be a white knuckle flyer in airliners. But since I got my pilot's license and now I'm so used to the motion of flight and me being in control of that motion, that now when I'm on an airliner, I find myself, you know, if I'm sort of dozing off, and we hit a little bit of turbulence, or maybe the plane turns a little bit, it'll jerk me awake because I'm like, whoa, what are they doing? What are they doing?
Right.
It's not me doing it, and it's a bit of a foreign feeling now. And I've heard that from other pilots, that they were perfectly fine riding on planes before they became a pilot, and now they can't take it anymore.
So what was the greatest challenge to you in doing this, in your initial education as a pilot?
You know, really just the biggest challenge is finding the time for it. You know, the big joke is that flying takes two things, time and money, and it takes a lot of both.
And what were you doing while you were learning to fly?
I was working full time, and not only full time, I was just starting out in the financial industry, which requires a bit of a hazing when you start out. And the hazing is that you're working 6 to 7 days a week, often 16-hour days. But again, it was just something that I really desperately wanted to do. And I would drive down to the airport where I was living in California, probably half asleep. And once I got to the airport, I was fully awake, fully functioning. And then I'd go to work really tired again.
There's something you communicate so beautifully in this book, and it's the camaraderie of small airports. And, you know, that whole culture of you fly in, you know, here's how you get your fuel. There's a courtesy car you can borrow if you're lucky. You know, it's this great recognition of shared experience, don't you think?
That's one of the things that I love about general aviation is that, you know, while it is sort of a fairly big community, it still has that small community feel. It's kind of old-fashioned. You know, we trust each other. We give each other our cars if we need it.
Yeah.
And we'll go out of our way to do things for other pilots or even just people in aviation in general. And, you know, I think that that's something that's missing from a lot of society now. And it's nice to be a part of that. It reminds you the way we should be.
And yet... As you know what's coming.
Yes.
It's a very sexist society.
It is. You know, I'll be the first to admit that there are more men who are supportive of women pilots than there are the haters, let's say. But the haters are rather outspoken.
Yes.
And they have some pretty ugly things to say about women pilots and even women drivers. And, you know, this is the 21st century, guys. Let's accept that we're a part of the industry now. And we are a very small part of the industry, mind you. Of the pilot population in the world, it's only about 5 to 6% are women. And, you know, it's less in some countries and more, for example, in the United States. But it's actually the same percentage that there was back when Amelia Earhart and 98 other pilots started a women's pilot organization called the 99s. It was the exact same percentage. So unfortunately, not much has changed.
Well, I loved it when you described meeting one of the Tuskegee Airmen and saying, I too am a minority in aviation.
He had the absolute best response. And he said, well, y'all were in it before we were.
I mean... That was a very dear thing to say.
That
I can see that whole
experience.
It got
me. I was like, oh, respect.
Yes, exactly. Now, one of the most memorable journeys you recount in this book is coming back home to New Orleans and flying across country with your father.
Yeah, I had lived in California for 4 years for work. After about a year, I was terribly homesick. Terribly homesick. Coming home as often as I could. So it did take a while to convince my boss to let me move back home. My job is solely on the computer, so there really is no reason to stay in an office. So once we had the plan set up, my father wanted to join me on the trip. He's not a pilot, but he loves to ride along. So he flew out one way to San Francisco. My movers took everything out one morning, and we left on a Good Friday in the afternoon after the movers had gone. And it took 16 hours total in the flight time. You know, the first day was a half a day on Good Friday, and then Saturday was the only full day. And of course, Texas is never ending.
Yes.
And then we actually arrived back home in time for Easter Sunday dinner, that half a day on Sunday. And it was one of the most spectacular trips I've done in a plane. And a lot of small airplane pilots don't take large trips like that. Either, you know, they can't get enough vacation time from work, or they're nervous about all the variables that go into it.
Right.
You know, your flight is really dictated by the weather. And then it's also dictated by your piloting skills. You know, can you fly at night? Can you fly on instruments?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that goes into it. And a lot of people end up not taking wonderful flights like that. And now, luckily, I've taken quite a few. And it's the most priceless way to see the country.
And to see it with your father.
Yes.
That was so special.
Yes.
It was fun to read about that. So describe for us buying your first plane, falling in love with a plane. You know, lots of people fall in love with Jaguars, but... Other people fall in love with planes.
I did quite quickly, but this was probably, I'd call it an impulse buy, which is a little weird. I really had absolutely zero plans to buy an airplane, and it all just happened by chance. The plane that I had been renting as a student pilot at the flying club that I belonged to suddenly was off the online scheduling system. And so I asked the front desk person when I went to the airport the next day, hey, whatever happened to 5900 Sierra Papa? And she wasn't sure. So, okay, I'll just rent another plane. I don't like it as much, but, you know, I just have to accept the fact. And it was still about a month later, you could still see it on the scheduling system, but you weren't able to schedule it. So I asked another person at the front desk, and he said, oh, well, it's up for sale. Okay. I had never actually thought about buying a plane. So I asked, did he have any idea how much it cost? I had no idea. And he didn't know either, but he said, well, I know it's up at a broker in Napa, so here's the broker's number. So I got home that day. I called the broker. He told me how much it was, and I thought about it because I had just gotten a bonus. And I was like, you know, I can do this.
Wow.
And so, you know, that day I called my parents and I told them that I was thinking about buying a plane. It was a long silence, of course. And then my dad said, well, you know, most people your age usually buy a house first. And, you know, this was in the Bay Area in California where houses are
right.
Just, you know, so I said, well, you know, I could never afford a house here as long as I live. And then they thought about it and they said, okay, fair enough.
You'll be happier in a plane, really.
Exactly. Yeah. And I said, you know, if I can't afford my rent, I'll just live in the plane.
And you named it Orion, which is a lovely name.
I did name it Orion the night that I went to pick it up in Napa after we had dinner at the airport. We were walking out to my new plane and shining right above it was the constellation Orion. And I had been fretting about the name. And as soon as I saw that, I snapped and was like, that's it.
It's
Orion.
Perfect. Just perfect. So what made you decide it was time to write a book about this?
I'm one of those people who, no matter where I go, I have these really odd experiences. And when I come home and tell the story, people are just constantly telling me, you really need to write this down. And this has truly been going on my whole life. And I guess finally I just took the time to sit down and do it.
And what did it do for you to write this book? I mean, how did it set your life in perspective? You're still really young. You know, when you write a memoir, you're reevaluating your life, seeing how you got from point A to point B. When you finished the last page, how did you feel about having written the book?
Nervous, I guess.
There's a lot of sex in this book, Erin.
There is. And yeah, that was definitely a worry with, oh my God, my parents know that I have sex, obviously, but do they need to know the details? But really in writing the book, you know, throughout my life now flying, I know that I'm not the only woman who has heard these things. And I'm afraid that there are a lot of them who get discouraged and end up getting out of the industry because of the negative things that they hear. And I'm hoping that the book will inspire not only women, but just anybody who wants to do something to just do it, no matter what people say. Because if you listen to those people, you won't end up doing anything, you know, because every hobby is different to people and they'll have something negative to say about it. Oh, why do you want to do that? That's crazy, or it's too expensive, or it takes too much time. There's always something that people can say to stop you from doing something. And I'm hoping that by writing this book, people will see, okay, she did it. She's a normal person, so I can do it too.
Absolutely. Well, it's so much fun. I really loved reading it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Erin Seidemann, whose new book is Postcards from the Sky, Adventures of an Aviatrix. You can also keep up with her on her blog, agirlinherplane.com. Erin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Come fly with me. Let's float down to Peru. In Lama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue.
It's the Christmas season in South Louisiana, and one of our most cherished traditions is that of the elaborate bonfires on the levee. New Orleans native Elizabeth Sanders takes that tradition and turns it into a story of love and loss in her remarkable debut novel, The Last Light. Elizabeth is speaking to us from her home in New York today. Elizabeth, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thank you.
The Last Light is a very compact book that really packs a punch, and it has such a lovely informing metaphor and such strong characters. So I'm curious, was going to these bonfires part of your family tradition when you were growing up?
Yes, we went to them a few times, and we definitely went to the big one in Algiers. But there was more to it that drew me to this story than just having it be a part of my childhood.
Oh, of course, of course. So tell us about the characters who populate this book.
Well, you have the two brothers who build the competing fires, Walter and Collins. And for me, I really wanted to explore what they were going through after their father had just passed the year before. And then you have Walter's wife, Phoebe, who I wanted to explore their relationship as they deal with love as empty nesters. And then there is Boone, who is my personal favorite character, who comes into the novel to help Walter build his fire.
I love Boone, too. Tell us about him. He's so adorable.
Right. This had actually started as a short story a long time ago, and he was one of those characters that kept me wanting to stay in the story and turn it into a novel, because I was just so drawn to his enthusiasm, I think.
And he tries to help Walter gather wood and think about how the fire should be built. And all along the way, he's looking for advice himself, isn't he?
He is, yes. He's looking for advice about life and love. And he thinks he's going to find it in Walter, but Walter is looking for the same answers as well.
Now, one of the things you do so beautifully is to render how family tradition is tied up with holiday markers. So Walter is dealing with his father's death for the first Christmas, and that's really a hard thing to go through.
Definitely. I'm lucky to not have experienced that myself. But yes, you know, holidays can be one of those perfect times to set fiction because everything is so heightened at that moment. And we do have so many rituals, and especially New Orleans. I mean, all of my stories are placed in New Orleans. It's so rich with family and cultural traditions and rituals, especially around the holidays. And I like how there is something inherited and collective about the sort of knowledge that's passed down in these rituals. And there's usually a great amount of secrecy that then is surrounded in them. And I really wanted to use that because it's a great world for a writer to then get in there and build their own history for these characters.
And then there's a great rivalry between Walter and Collins, not just with the fires, but, I mean, two brothers couldn't be more different, don't you think? I mean,
oh, definitely.
That must have been fun to write.
It was. To kind of find these two men who are extremely different, but at the same time, they have this sort of love and this sort of passion, even though if they're not ready to admit it, to return back to their grandparents' house in Vacherie, Louisiana. And, you know, I think the farther away they get from their childhood, the more they realize how fleeting it is and how kind of desperate they are for something like that to hold on to.
And Walter is a doctor. He's a serious doctor, and he's dealing with life and death things all the time. And Collins is a little more easygoing.
He is more easygoing, definitely. And, you know, Walter seems to have this much more intense life and stuff. But, you know, one of the changes that I wanted to see at the end was that Collins is also going through this very sad time with his own wife, and that sometimes that's how life is. Just when you think that your life is the hardest, you turn around and it's actually the person that's standing next to you who needs you the most.
Right. Now, I notice the incredible amount of detail in this book. It's so closely observed. There are little hiccups of recognition as you're reading along. And I have to say, one of my favorite sentences, it made me kind of smile. The way he says it sounds misplaced, like a Wagner's meat market attached to a gas station. I think any New Orleanian is going to read that and go, oh, yeah.
Anybody that's driven to the airport.
Right. But you did have to learn an awful lot about wood and fires and all kinds of things for this book, which I found fascinating.
Yes, I did a lot of research for it. I love doing research. I love making image banks and language banks. You know, but I have two brothers, and they're the type of men who just, they know a lot about that stuff. They know a lot about nature, and so I definitely use them as a resource at times.
And there's a lot of hunting and gathering. When Walter drives around the city, he's looking at trees and lumber and pallets behind Walmart, and he gets into some crazy situations as a result of this obsession.
Right. I wanted the reader to get a sense of this sort of madness that takes over. Once you see at the end of the book, this madness that takes over really isn't about this bonfire, and it's a way for him to try to escape him feeling like his life is kind of collapsing around him.
So did you actually have to do a lot of research for this book, or did you draw on a lot of memory?
No, I actually did a lot of research. Yes, it actually is more these characters' history than my own.
And what was surprising to you about that?
I mean, I think that you start to get very involved with these characters and you don't want to let them go and you become very involved in their stories. And as with any New Orleans thing that I write, I sit back and then fall in love with the city all over again, and I can't wait to be down there next week.
So what's next for you? Do you feel like Louisiana is truly your subject matter? Is that really where you want to focus your energies?
It is. Most of my writing does, pretty much all of it, takes place down in New Orleans. It's where my characters are either from. It's where the action's taking place. I am currently working on a cross-genre book about women in war. And a significant part of it takes place in New Orleans, or characters who are from New Orleans. And then I'm also finishing up a second novel about a young man who is a passenger in a car that kills a young boy and kind of what he goes through. And it's a play on the beautiful New Orleans heat as his captor.
Oh, well, that's easy to do. Do you feel like growing up in New Orleans gives you an edge as a writer? I often wonder that.
I think that there is a romance to that city that is inescapable. And I do, I think as an artist, you're taught from a young age this sort of rhythm to life that helps you create. I do, yes.
And you published this book with Broken Levee Books, which is an imprint of Chin Music Press, which has brought us some gorgeous New Orleans titles. It must have been a lot of fun for you to work with them.
It was amazing. It's owned by two brothers, Bruce and David, and David edited the book, and they're so passionate about New Orleans art and literature, and so they were just so enthusiastic, and David brought so much brilliant insight to my work that I hadn't seen before, and it was a really great experience.
Well, and we're talking about Bruce and David Rutledge here, who've brought us so many fine New Orleans books. Well, congratulations. I can't wait for your next book. This was really a very moving book. It's so brief, but it's so unforgettable. You know, you really packed so much into it. That's what I loved about it.
Thank you so much.
Well, we've been talking with Elizabeth Sanders, whose new book, her first novel, is the very fine novel, The Last Light. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can see it from the river to the top of White Pine Ridge, burning like a summer sun. Rudolph's nose was lit with Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, and Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, and Blitzen. At the bonfire out in the sticks, country backwoods, homegrown hicks. Bonfire, dance a little jig, pull up your eggnog and take another swig. I won't sleep till dawn, gonna party right down to the wire. Sleigh bells, when old Santa Claus pulled up, we all got a little nervous, 'cause we ain't been good enough. He popped the top and hollered real loud, don't worry y'all, I came to hang out. At the bonfire out in the sticks, country backwoods, homegrown hicks. Bonfire, dance a little jig, pull up your eggnog and take another swig. Won't sleep till
there are books for all seasons at my house, and Christmas is no exception. Around this time of year, I always start pulling down the old favorites. First come the cookbooks, especially those old plastic spiral-bound regional cookbooks, and then I look through my recipe box, looking for those index cards that have come down to me in the handwriting of my grandmother and my mother. And then it's on to those childhood favorites. I hardly need to look at How the Grinch Stole Christmas anymore. Years of reading it to my children have engraved it on my heart. I still stumble over the songs in the televised version, though I've got You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch down perfectly. And I always go back to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, reminding myself of the terrible reign of the White Witch. We learn what it means when it's always winter, never Christmas, think of that. And the thaw that inevitably comes when Father Christmas makes his rounds. Two of my treasured volumes are oddly shaped. There's the giant, oversized Bavard in Father Christmas, which tells of the beloved elephant's quest to find Father Christmas and bring him back to the elephant country. It's so big and bright and gorgeous, and rather than being printed, the text is in the most appealing cursive round script. It's one of those books that a little kid can hide behind, lost in a complete world. And then there's the tall book of Christmas, which my Granny Anna gave to me when I was 8 years old, visiting her home in Kansas for my first white Christmas. I was falling in love with fairy tales then and was completely drawn in by this tall, thin, charming book with stories selected by Dorothy Hall Smith and charming, warm illustrations by Gertrude Espensheed. One of my favorite stories is The Christmas of the Bears, in which a bear who's having trouble hibernating frightens off Santa's reindeer and then fills in for them. He awakens in the spring to his very own Christmas tree, complete with salmon and honeycombs, a good deed rewarded. A Christmas Carol is always a candidate for rereading, and I do love the way the members of the Dickens Fellowship gather to read a section aloud, complete with the dandy beverage called Smoking Bishop, and pudding as well, in the best classical Dickensian tradition. Two stories in Larry Dark's wonderful anthology, A Literary Christmas, draw me in year after year. In Grace Paley's wonderful story, The Loudest Voice, Shirley Abramovich gets offered the big role of narrator in her school Christmas pageant. Her Jewish mother objects, but her Jewish father tells her to go ahead. After all, he points out, Ho, ho, my father said, Christmas, what's the harm? After all, history teaches everyone. We learn from reading this is a holiday from pagan times also, candles, lights, even Hanukkah. So we learn it's not altogether Christian. So if they think it's a private holiday, they're only ignorant, not patriotic. What belongs to history belongs to all men. You want to go back to the Middle Ages? Is it better to shave your head with a secondhand razor? Does it hurt Shirley to learn to speak up? It does not. So maybe someday she won't live between the kitchen and the shop. She's not a fool. And Shirley thinks, I thank you, Papa, for your kindness. It is true about me to this day. I'm foolish, but I am not a fool. Another favorite is the H Street Sledding record by Ron Carlson. In this, a young father, in the early days of family life, celebrates the value of tradition by going to a nearby farm, gathering a bushel of manure, and flinging it onto his rooftop as proof of the existence of Santa's reindeer. I understand this story. For years, when my children were little, the last sound they heard was that of ringing bells. Even now, that's the last thing I do every Christmas Eve, ring those bells, no matter who's home. My husband and I used to rush to do our assembly work, and then we would ceremoniously shake hands and exchange our own holiday greetings. Well done, Santa Claus. Well done, Mrs. Claus. All parents know that pleasure of making something wonderful happen for your kids, no matter what time of year. The stories we write for ourselves and our family traditions, as well as the stories we read, are some of the greatest joys of the season. Make your holiday one to remember. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Burlesque Press presents the Hands-On Literary Festival, December 28th through 31st at the Maison St. Charles Hotel. The theme this year is the politics and power of place and space. The keynote speaker is Dorothy Allison, and other featured guests include Meredith Allen, Moira Crone, John Gary, Roger Kamenetz, Bill Lavender, Bill Lofelm, Biljana Obradovic, Daniel Wallace, and Tani V. Waters. The panels and presentations conclude with a New Year's Eve ball. For more information or to register, check out handsonball.com. If you're looking to make a difference in someone's life by giving the gift of reading in 2016, think about becoming a volunteer for STAIR. Start the adventure in reading. Tutor training classes begin Wednesday, January 6th. Only 1 2-hour training session is required, and no experience is necessary. Volunteers are needed after school or on Saturday mornings at STAIR-operated sites in Orleans, Jefferson, and Plaquemines parishes. Tutor training sessions will be held Thursday, January 7th at 1:30, Saturday, January 9th at 9:30, and Monday, January 11th at 3:30 at the Land Building, 1535 State Street behind St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian Church, and Saturday, January 16th at 9:30 at the Woodland Preservation Church, 5824 Berkeley Drive. To register for training, contact Elizabeth at the STAIR office at 504-899-0820 or email elizabeth@stairnola.org. The website is stairnola.org. Also coming up in the new year, Page Flippers, a quarterly series of reading books aloud, starts January 14th at 7 at Pelican Bay Restaurant, 1701 Elysian Fields. The first book is Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. Reading slots are available the night of the event for 6 readers, up to 10 minutes each. Sign up is first come, first served, and readers can pick their favorite pages. A copy of The Bluest Eye will be available to read from, or please bring your own. This is not a book club, although input is appreciated for future book choices. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading. ¶¶